slides in and the video clips. And one is the prophecy debate we did down in Orange County. That's a two-hour event, so that's a little easier project. And then the really big project is the 40-hour course I taught at Tozer Seminary. So, and unfortunately, that particular set of recordings needs to be edited in real time. So we need somebody who can help us with a significant part of that 40 hours. So if you're interested and I have time to do that, please call our office, talk to Jimmy, and we'll get that set up, because we have people waiting for those things and we've just been kind of sitting on them because of the labor shortage we have.
What skills are required?
You need to have your eyes open. Jimmy will train you in everything you need to know, and it doesn't take that. I mean, in terms of putting in the video clips and the slides, it's just kind of like watching the video and figure out a good place for them to go. So, you know, when I'm doing something stupid in front of the audience, that's a good place to stick it in. So,
voiceover.
Well, that's it. What they do is you hear my voice, but the slide goes up or the video clip goes up. But also, the digitizing needs to be done in real time, because they did it all of these tapes. So that needs to be taken care of. Hey, before we get started into Psalm 139, and by the way, we don't have a testimony today, but I'm hoping to elicit some testimonies as we go through the principle of God's control over the events in our life, particularly life and death. Saving your life and bringing death. But before we do that, I do have a discovery I want to describe for you. How many planets do you think have been discovered outside of our solar system? I remember when I was a graduate student in astronomy at the University of Toronto, astronomers were saying, we'll never find planets outside of our solar system. We're stuck with only knowing about the planets inside our solar system. I remember taking a course from Carl Sagan where he said, there's got to be at least 10 billion planets in our galaxy alone. They said, we'll never be able to find them. Well, we have been finding them. Any idea how many we've found so far? Anybody hesitate to guess? 84? 400?
We did have 450, but I think...
Oh, he knows. So.
Kepler has another 450 coming up.
Well, we're now at, as of this morning, 464 planets discovered outside of our solar system. But yeah, within the next 3 years, that'll probably go up to about 10,000 planets outside of our solar system. Yes?
Did you see that picture on TV? They took a picture of the whole solar system. Did you see that?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
It showed the Milky Way. It's kind of like just a fuzzy line across it. But the whole thing looks like this.
I think it was the astronomy picture of the day yesterday.
Yes.
Where they showed four planets along the ecliptic, and it's really rare. I mean, the ecliptic is basically the plane of our solar system, and the planets, you know, will revolve around the sun on that plane. But it's really rare is to have them all on the plane, because they go up and down. But yeah, what they showed on astronomy picture of the day yesterday is they're all in a perfect line, four of them. And, you know, that almost never happens, where you get them all in the, because usually one's up and one's down. But they're all right there in the plane. Happens about once every couple hundred years. So that was a rare event that all of you missed. Well, we do miss it because you can only see it from the southern hemisphere. So that's something that Wes Ringer has on the rest of us. He was able to see it, but we can't. By the way, do be in prayer for Wes. He is trying to get out of the country. And, you know, when he talked about elections, the thing I noticed in my trips to Africa is that when elections happen, you get a lot of murders. People basically murder you if you vote outside your tribe, which kind of explains why in Africa democracy has such a hard time gaining a hold, because no matter whether you like the guy or not, if he's part of your tribe, you have to vote for him. And if you don't, people in your tribe are going to get after you. So that's why Rep West is really wanting to get out. He doesn't want to be in the line of fire, and I don't blame him. So... And they never told me how dangerous it was when I was there, except one time I was in a car, and they said, and there was five other guys in the car. I said, it's awfully crowded here. And they says, well, we're putting you in the middle. Duck behind the windows. We don't want your head showing, and because they're worried that the car might get shot out. So fortunately, no shots, and all of us arrived fine. But I was impressed that they were willing to protect me personally to that degree. So, but I didn't get to see anything outside the windows except up. So, interesting situation. Actually, kind of fits into this how God kind of saves your life in miraculous ways. But no, this is a paper that got published by two astronomers at Caltech just a few days ago. And they're addressing the problem of why all these extrasolar planets we've discovered are so very different than the ones we see in our solar system. Because the expectation was when we find these extrasolar planets, they're going to appear to be analogs to the planets in our solar system, and they're nothing like it. And so what they're doing is working on detailed models to explain why our solar system has such a unique configuration. Because a typical situation that we see in these extrasolar planetary systems is gas giants will form just beyond the snow line. The snow line is that distance from the star where water turns to ice, so they call it the snow line. And because you have the gases in a frozen state, that's the place, the best place to make the gas giants. If you're farther out, there won't be as much gas to form a planet. And if you're closer in, then it won't be in a frozen form. And so that's where you're going to get the formation of your gas giant planets. But what we see in other extraplanetary systems is that once these gas giants planets form, they either wind up with extremely eccentric orbits or they wind up drifting in close to their star. And both are prescriptions that would eliminate the possibility of a small planet like Earth with the capacity to support intelligent life. Because if you've got big planets far away from the star with highly eccentric orbits, what I mean by eccentric orbit is, Newton's laws of motion say that when one body orbits another, it's never a circular orbit. It's always slightly elliptical. And so eccentricity measures how elliptical it is. What we're seeing in these extrasolar planetary systems is that if they're out as far away as where Jupiter is, the orbit tends to be very eccentric indeed. And if it's very eccentric, that means it's going to be much closer to the star at parts of its orbit and much farther away at other parts. And that's a prescription for disturbing the orbits of small planets that are orbiting close to the star, such as planets like Venus, Earth, Mars, and Mercury. So that's not a good situation if you're looking for a place where advanced life can possibly exist. But the other thing they notice is that if it does have a circular orbit, then the gas giants are orbiting at about the same distance that Mercury, Venus, and Earth does. In fact, we're finding all kinds of things that we call hot Jupiters. A hot Jupiter is a planet as big as Jupiter or bigger that's orbiting its star closer than Mercury orbits our star. So yeah, it's hot because it's so close to the star, it gets heated up. But when you have a gas giant move like that from the snow line beyond the snow line in close, that's going to disturb the orbital patterns of any small bodies that are orbiting close. Yes.
Wouldn't that close proximity cook off the gas on the planet?
It will cook off the gas if the planet is small. If it's big as Jupiter, then it'll have sufficient gravity that it doesn't have its gas robbed by the star.
It'd be like a pressure cooker, though, wouldn't it? I mean, that gas body, because all that energy of the sun is so close going into it.
Well, what astronomers are observing is that with hot Jupiters, you've got a decent probability that it will occasionally cross in front of the star from our line of sight. So the star is here, and the hot Jupiter is orbiting it. And if the plane of the orbit is somewhat in our line of sight, you will occasionally see transits. A transit is where the planet passes exactly between you and the star. And as it comes into the star's limb, you'll see the light of the star dim a little bit, and then as it gets completely in, it'll get fully dimmed, and as it comes out, you'll see that it goes from dim to eventually the normal brightness. Well, as that planet enters into the limb of the star and out of the limb of the star, that gives you an opportunity to measure its diameter. By measuring its diameter and knowing its mass, you can figure out what kind of an atmosphere it's got. And what it's actually revealing is that the heat of the star tends to expand the atmosphere. So they tend to be a little on the large size. And also, when a planet is, say, several times the mass of Jupiter, it will tend to have a really big atmosphere. So, but yeah, if it's a small one like the size of Uranus or Neptune, then the star, unless it's a very faint star, will begin to boil off the atmosphere. Yes?
Is it possible that these close-in gas giants have the greatest probability of interfering with the light from the star, and so those are the ones we detect? And there may be others out there with some frequency that don't do that, and we don't detect them.
Well, there's two primary detection techniques that are used to find these planets. The first one that was successful was looking at what's called the radio velocity of the star. And you can't see the planet, but you can see the star. And as a planet orbits around a star, its gravity, when it's on this side, will pull the star towards you, and when it's on the opposite side, will pull a star away from you. And so by looking at the spectral lines and measuring the red shifts and the blue shifts, we can determine the orbit and the mass of the planet orbiting the star, assuming it's big enough to actually have a significant disturbance. That technique is now getting down to where they're able to measure the red shift and the blue shift to 5 and 6 places of the decimal. So they're even finding planets by that technique that are just a little bit bigger than the Earth. I mean, they're at the verge of discovering planets the size of the Earth with that technique. Now, the other technique that will work on planets even smaller than the Earth is a transit method, where you count on the planet passing between you and the star, which causes the star to dim a little bit. So if you can accurately measure the light output of the star, thereby you can detect planets. But the vast majority of planets that are out there are not going to be transiting. So you're only going to get a few percent that will have those transit experiences, but a few percent out of 10 billion planets is still a lot of planets. And so the quest to find planets the size of the Earth orbiting about the same distance that our Earth does, and therefore possible candidates for life, is transit methods that are have the potential of picking those up. Yeah, and astronomers are on the verge of finding planets the size and even smaller than that of the Earth, and already the evidence is tilting that we're probably going to find quite a lot of them. But what this paper is pointing out, finding planets like Earth is probably not a good chance at all. Earth is really showing up to be unique as the configurations that we're seeing in these extrasolar planetary systems are such that they would not permit a planet like Earth to exist. But these two Caltech astronomers are really interested because what they were seeing is that these gas giants that form outside the snow line form in the context of giant belts of asteroids and comets. And what these belts do is they gravitationally interact with the planets to get what's called type 2 migration, which means that the gas giant planets, as they interact with the remaining debris, planetesimals, comets, and asteroids, they drift in. So it explains why we see gas giants so close to their stars, because they can't form there. It's too hot for them to form where they are. They must have formed outside the snow line and drifted in. So there's really good understanding now of how gas giants drift inward towards their planet. But clearly what happened in our solar system is it went the opposite way, is that they formed outside the snow line, and Jupiter is just barely outside the snow line today, but the planets drifted outward. So it did the opposite kind of migration that we see in these other planetary systems. And that can happen, and we do see it happening in these extrasolar planetary systems, what's called scattering. When it interacts with these giant belts of asteroids and comets, you will get inward drift, but you'll also get scattering as they gravitationally interact with one another. But the scattering causes the gas giant planets to have high inclinations and high eccentricities. Inclination refers to the tilt of the planet's orbit relative to the orbit of the main system of the planets and the star itself. But we don't see that with Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. They have very close to zero inclinations and very close to zero eccentricity. And so that's where they stand unique. We are living in the only planetary system where we got gas giants that are far from the star, where they have very low eccentricity and very low inclination, all of which are requirements to have advanced life here on our planet Earth. Without that, our orbit would be too disturbed for us to be able to exist. So what this paper is doing is trying to understand, okay, how is it possible that you're going to get the outward drift and wind up with gas giants that have low eccentricities and low inclinations? And the other problem they're trying to solve is what we notice in our our planetary system, the biggest gas giant is closest to the star. The second biggest is the next closest. And you've got Uranus and Neptune that are considerably smaller farther away. And that's actually the ideal configuration to optimally protect the Earth from taking too many hits from asteroids and comets. Now, I think it was 2 weeks ago I told you about that big hit that Jupiter took last June. And how we now realize that the solar system is a fairly dangerous place, but thanks to the configuration of the gas giants, it's optimally safe. Well, what these two Caltech astronomers did is they said, okay, let's look at the initial conditions of our solar system. And we have a fair idea of what those initial conditions were just because of the mix of the chemicals we know the Earth would have inherited from its birthing star cluster, and for the supernova and asymptotic giant branch stars that were enriching it with all these elements. So they know those initial conditions. But they said, let's play with a bunch of other initial conditions and see if we can ever come up with a situation where we get the current configurations of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And what they've discovered is it takes a highly fine-tuned Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets. I mean, you know, our current solar system has three belts of asteroids and comets. You've got what's called the main belt, which is between Jupiter and Saturn. That's kind of a misnomer because we now know it's the smallest of the three belts. Between Jupiter and Mars. It's in between Jupiter and Mars. In the textbooks, it's called the main belt. It was the first one discovered. In fact, for a long time, we only knew of that one belt. But now we know there are two bigger belts. The Kuiper belt, which is beyond the orbit of Neptune, and goes out for another 2 or 3 billion miles beyond Neptune. Neptune orbits at about 4 billion miles from the Sun. So somewhere between 4 and 7 billion miles, you've got the Kuiper belt of asteroids and comets. And then way beyond that, I'm talking 1 to 2 trillion miles away, you've got the Oort cloud. That's the biggest of the three clouds, but it's not the densest. The densest of the clouds is the Kuiper belt. And it's the Kuiper belt that has the biggest factor in determining the dynamics of the early history of the solar system. Moreover, we now know that the Kuiper belt was 100 times bigger until about 3.9 billion years ago. So for the first 700 million years of the history of the solar system, we had this giant Kuiper belt. And that would normally cause the gas giants to move inward. But what they discovered in this research paper, it will go the opposite way if Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune start off with tight mean motion resonances. And it will only work if they start with these tight mean motion resonances. And say, what on earth are you talking about? A mean motion resonance is where you got one planet making a low integer number of orbits about its star for another low number of integer orbits of a second star. So, for example, we have things called a 2-3 resonance. A 2-3 resonance is where one gas giant planet would make two orbits about the star for exactly every three orbits of a second gas giant planet. And so you've got a 2-3, a 1-2, a 3-4, 3-5. That's what we mean by low integer mean motion resonances. And what this paper came up with was eight different configurations, four of which were much more likely than the other four, which would work to cause the planets to drift outward, but also they're such that they would cause Jupiter and Saturn to have highly eccentric orbits initially and then evolve to become circular over the course of a few hundred million years. Yes?
Is that ratio? The other thing is the equivalent mass of all these giants and planets and their movements, does that equate to some sort of a balance? It's like on a, like, you know, like a car tire spinning around with a without a weight, you know, it'll have an eccentricity forming from that as the faster you go. But if they're all kind of moving at that ratio and their masses, does that create some sort of a balance?
Well, not so much of a balance, but it causes the interaction equations to change sign. And so instead of the gravitational influence of the Kuiper belt objects causing these gas giant planets to drift inward, it causes them to drift outward. And so they would form at the snow line, which was the snow line is between Mars and Jupiter. So they would form there in a tight bunch. That's the other thing this paper found out. It only works if Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune form in a rather compact configuration. And they form with these low integer mean motion resonances. With that condition and only that condition, will you get an outward drift where Jupiter and Saturn begin with extremely eccentric orbits, but over hundreds of millions of years they evolve to become circular. And they evolve out to the position. The other thing that makes it work, you have to fine-tune the masses. They discovered in their research that if you made the masses of the four giants significantly different than what we see in our solar system, then it doesn't work. So the masses have to be fine-tuned. You have to fine-tune the mean motion resonances, and you have to fine-tune the configuration of the Kuiper belt to get it all to work. And bottom line of the paper is, we now know why the solar system is unique. The probability of this happening anywhere else is vanishingly small, if not zero. Yes.
So the anthropic factors keep growing.
The anthropic factors keep growing. Now, the researchers don't mention the anthropic factors, but they said this does explain why we see a unique situation here. But, yeah, that's the implication, is that God was the one that was fine-tuning all this to get everything just right.
What happened to all the early mass in the Kuiper belt?
That is solved, too. Although these two gentlemen didn't take credit for that. They said there was a solution published earlier. That, you know, here you have the four gas giants forming in a tight clump, and then you've got this just right initial conditions, which causes them to drift outward. But you have Saturn a little closer to the center of mass for the Kuiper belt than Jupiter. And Uranus and Neptune don't matter too much because they're low mass bodies relative to Jupiter and Saturn. The crucial thing is Jupiter and Saturn. But with Saturn being a little closer to the center of the mass, it actually drifts outward at a more rapid rate than Jupiter does. And then it reaches a point after 700 million years of this evolution where you have Jupiter making exactly two orbits for every single orbit of Saturn. Now, that's the most impactful or devastating of the mean motion resonances. That gives you the strongest gravitational impulses to the rest of the solar system. 3-5, you're not going to get them lining up that frequently. But a 1-2 means that for every orbit of Saturn, you're going to get a lineup. And you're getting a lineup of the two biggest, most massive planets. And what that did, that 1-2 resonance, is it destabilized the entire Kuiper belt, basically scattered the Kuiper belt objects, many of which left the solar system completely. Many got absorbed into Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune. A whole lot got absorbed into the Sun. And then the inner solar system planets got heavily bombarded, which is what we call the late heavy bombardment. And, you know, this paper doesn't do, but other papers have done it, where they've actually tried to calculate the time scale to reach that 1-2 resonance. And it's roughly equivalent to the dates that we see for the big craters on the Moon, Mercury, and Mars. If you look at those three bodies, they're all cratered, and all three bodies have low levels of erosion. The Moon the least. Moon has a very tiny atmosphere of argon, but because of that tiny atmosphere, by the way, you're always going to get argon on a body, because argon is a radiometric daughter product. Potassium-40 decays into argon-40. And so if you wait long enough, a body will accumulate argon. In fact, Earth's atmosphere is 1% argon. And that argon all came from radiometric decay. That's one reason why we know the Earth must be about 4 or 5 billion years old, because of the quantity of argon. Well, the Moon had the same thing going on for it, so it's got this small argon atmosphere. And what that does is it very, very slowly erodes the craters. And by measuring the erosion that we can see on the Moon's craters, we can tell when they formed. 95% of them form between 3.8 and 3.9 billion years ago. That's the late heavy bombardment. You get the same date when you look at the weathering of the craters on Mercury. Mercury's got a little bit heavier atmosphere than the Moon does, and so the weathering is a little more noticeable. And then, of course, on Mars, it's very noticeable, but you do have craters on Mars where the erosion is such that we can actually date that, yes, they too formed between 3.8 and 3.9 billion years ago. And, yeah, that's crucial for advanced life on our planet for two reasons. The late heavy bombardment was responsible for infusing sulfur and oxygen into the liquid core of the Earth. And without that infusion of oxygen and sulfur, we wouldn't have long-lasting, strong plate tectonic activity and a long-lasting, strong magnetic field. That magnetic field is crucial to preserve the atmosphere of the Earth. Without that magnetic field, the magnetic field of the sun would send charged particles, which would sputter away our atmosphere over a few billion years. The magnetic field of the Earth stopped that. And likewise, you need the plate tectonics to form the continents to coexist with the oceans. So late heavy bombardment was a blessing for that particular reason. It was also a blessing in that it removed 99% of the Kuiper Belt objects from the solar system. If you had a big Kuiper Belt today, we'd be being bombarded a lot more frequently than we are. If you ever want to go a little bit east of Phoenix, you'll see a bombardment event. There's a crater out there, the Winslow Crater, that's about a mile in diameter, that happened about 10,000 years ago. And that was a 100-foot diameter rock that blew that that crater out. And you don't want that happening every day. And that would have been the case if the Kuiper Belt didn't get scattered about 700 million years ago. And likewise, the Kuiper Belt gives us one of our strongest arguments for a supernatural origin of life, because the late heavy bombardment sterilized the planet, and yet within a few tens of millions of years after the height of the late heavy bombardment, we see life abundant in planet Earth, proving that the origin of life happened quickly, not slowly, like evolutionists would require in their models. So that's a long answer, but thank God for that 1-2 resonance that happened 700 million years after the Earth had formed. Yes, Sal?
Yeah, why doesn't the Oort cloud and the Kuiper Belt, why don't they clump together and form planets or a planet? Why do they all stay as debris?
Well, that's a good question. You get your most efficient planetary formation episode when you got what are called planetesimals existing. And planetesimals are bodies that are between the size of small planets and asteroids and comets. And that will happen when you have a situation where you've got lots of comets and asteroids mixed in what they call polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. That's a multiple-syllable word that basically means the stuff that kind of sticks to the grill of your barbecue. Those are aromatic polycyclic hydrocarbons. And one of the things you notice when you try to clean your barbecue, that stuff is really sticky. And it's hard to get off your barbecue. Well, with lots of that stuff in the early solar system mixed in with these planetesimals, asteroids, and comets, you've got a nice environment for the formation of a planetary, small terrestrial planetary bodies. Now, for the gas giants, it's a different situation because they're basically collecting gas out of the primordial disk that surrounds the star. And so, you know, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune are essentially, we call them gas giants because that's their predominant constituent. But to form planets like Earth, Venus, and Mars, you need these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, lots of planetesimals, and asteroids and comets in order to get the stuff to come together. So, and you need low-velocity collision events. So, as we mentioned, the bombardment that formed the Moon was a planet about twice the size of Mars experiencing a low-velocity collision event with a primordial Earth. And when the collision is small and you got lots of water on the planet, then you can get one body being absorbed into the other. Otherwise, it's like two billiard balls bouncing off one another, which is going to shatter the planets or do something else destructive. So, yeah, you need fine-tuned conditions just to get these rocky planets to form. Yes. How far after the formation of the Earth did the moon-forming event happen? Well, John Davis here gave me a paper 2 weeks ago where they said they wanted to revise the date of 30 million years and make it 120 million years. So, that study is still ongoing as to what kind of date we can come up with, but what is interesting is the net effect of the collision event, whether it's 30 million, 40 million, 50, or 120 million years, is identical. So the timing of the event, that doesn't seem to make much difference as long as it happens relatively early. And the whole debate is over how old is the moon. We do know the moon is younger than the Earth, but there's different ways of dating the origin of the moon, and those discordant dates that are causing the debate over when this collision took place. So, and incidentally, it was a discovery that the moon was younger than the Earth that first led astronomers to actually pursue the idea that this collision must have happened. Because if they formed at the same time, then there was basically just part of the same formation. But all of our models tell us you can't get a big moon around a small planet close to the star if they're forming of the primordial nebula. You do need a later collision event to make it work. So that's one thing you can thank your taxpayers, your government officials for, is funding the Apollo program. It was the Apollo program that opened up the door for us to discover what the moon was all about. Well, the reflectors are still on the moon, and they're still using those reflectors to measure the distance that the moon is spiraling away from the Earth per year, and also to test different theories of general relativity. So people who claim that the Apollo astronauts never made it to the moon, that it was all faked inside a Hollywood studio, well, the problem is those reflectors are there. Somebody must have put those reflectors there. They didn't get there by themselves, so, and they're still there. So you can go, if you've got the right laser equipment, you can pick that stuff up. Yes?
Could you repeat that time interval between the late heavy bombardment and the appearance of light? Did you say 10,000 years?
Well, we know the late heavy bombardment peaked between about 3.85 and 3.89 billion years ago. And we see evidence for abundant life on planet Earth that dates as early as 3.83 billion years. And so the situation for the evolutionists is that clearly there's going to be a time lag between the height of the late heavy bombardment and when you're going to get liquid water and solid rocks forming on the Earth. That'd be the earliest moment where an origin of life would even be conceivable. And as a number of origin of life researchers have pointed out, the moment you got liquid water and solid rocks, you got life. Which has led, I think it was Niles Eldridge to say, as an atheist, that life must be intrinsic to the Earth. And what he meant by that is there must be some fundamental physical principle that guarantees the moment that you got liquid water, you're going to get life. I'd say it's a metaphysical answer as to why you get it so quickly. Yes? Yeah, go ahead.
Number of years of the time interval, because I've got to be approximately. Did you say 10,000 years?
No, that was a quote I made about the time interval between the Triassic dinosaurs' disappearance and the appearance of the Jurassic dinosaurs. For the origin of life, we know it's a few million years with big error bars. The whole thing is, okay, we need to date the peak of the late heavy bombardment, which is plus or minus 20 million years. And then we need to figure out how long you would need for the conditions of the late heavy bombardment to where you would have liquid water and rocks upon the surface of the Earth. But the 3.83 billion year date for the first life is consistent with the date for the earliest rocks and liquid water on the face of the Earth. So now there are episodes before that where you get rocks and liquid water, but that's immaterial because a late heavy bombardment would clearly be a sterilization event.
The other thing was the wind's low.
The Winslow crater, when you go out there, you'll see signs pointing out that it was roughly equal to or maybe a little bit more of an energy release than the atomic bomb that exploded over Hiroshima. So, I mean, it blew out a crater almost a mile in diameter and 350 feet deep. So that's a lot of energy. And you wouldn't want that happening in downtown Los Angeles. So, yes.
This is a bit of a non sequitur, but we talk about metaphysical and we talk about supernatural. But is it and we have those people who are dedicated to the naturalistic and the materialistic. But is it true that the boundary of the naturalistic keeps creeping outward, as we saw with the Big Bang and the space-time theorems and additional discoveries that give us glimpses of origins beyond scientific explanation?
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, scientists do admit that when they look at the origin of the universe, they're seeing increasing difficulties with the naturalistic explanation. Same thing for the origin of life and the origin of humanity. So, but those who are atheists in the field are still holding out hope that maybe there's something we haven't discovered yet. In the case of the origin of life, you got the Santa Fe Institute saying there's got to be a hidden law of physics, or what Niles Eldridge is saying, it's intrinsic to the Earth. And what he's implying by that is there's some undiscovered law of physics that would guarantee the spontaneous production of life, but without any evidence.
But isn't this a little silly in that we know that at the moment of origin, time and space and matter and energy were all created, and the laws of, along with the laws of physics and all the naturalistic processes. So, I mean, isn't this a little short-sighted?
Well, it is, but to be fair, it's wrong to say that amongst physical scientists that you have a large population of atheists. It's actually very few. I mean, in terms of the astronomers and research that I know of, you can probably count the number of true atheists on one or two hands. Most of them take a deistic position, that there's a God out there who set up all of physics, that created space, time, matter, and energy, got the universe going, but going in such a way that he was able to take a long nap afterwards for several billion years and then not intervene and let all of his laws do everything thereafter. But then the origin of life begins to cause him the problem. And things like this paper is talking about causing the problem. So that's kind of why I'm bringing it up, is that it's becoming progressively more and more difficult to take a deistic position on these things. But yeah, sometimes Christians make the mistake of saying these scientists are all atheists. Well, in fact, very few of them are atheists, or at least true atheists. A lot of them will say, I just don't know, or I haven't thought about it. And that's a problem, too, with a lot of research scientists. They're so focused on their narrow discipline of research, they don't have time to think about the metaphysical issues until they get sick or something happens, and then they start thinking about it. Okay. Steve?
Clarify the theory RTB a little bit for me on late heavy bombardment and life as compared to Schroeder. For RTB, if I understand it correctly, the first life and first formation of Earth and everything in the scripture happens in a gap between verses 1 and 2 in Genesis 1. What Schroeder would consider to be a heading and not creation, yet he would consider life to be in day 3 when God called earth and called water, gave it a name. And that life, plants, could be the three kingdoms of life we have nowadays, bacteria, archaea, and eukarya. It has those genetics there. But for the RTB theory, to put life back in the heading, or as you would say, day one, in that gap, could there have been life before the late heavy bombardment that in that gap was destroyed, heavy bombardment, and then life again? Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility, which is the reason Fuzz and I titled our book Origins of Life, because we don't know that much about the Hadean era. We do know that there were brief episodes in the Hadean era where the planet returned to a condition where you could have liquid water and solid rocks. But each of those episodes were quite brief. But we said, we don't put it past the Creator that he might have taken advantage of those brief episodes to make a limited amount of life, if for no other reason to get the chemistry jump started, so that once the late heavy bombardment is over, then you could really put life on planet Earth in great diversity and abundance. And indeed, the chemical signatures tell us that life indeed was quite abundant and diverse right back to 3.8 billion years ago. But that's a possibility. It's also possible that the Creator said, you know, let's wait until things are really optimal and then we'll do it. The answer will be, how aggressive must the Creator be to get things ready for human beings in the narrow window of time in which we can exist? And so at this point, we don't know whether in the context of the history of the Earth, you would want the Creator intervening previous to the late heavy bombardment or not. It's an open question. But you are right, our model is that you have the origin of life at the beginning of day one. And you know how you interpret Genesis 1:2 and Genesis 1:3, that again is something that is open for research and interpretation. So in that sense, as with any model, our model is still in a state of flux. Yeah.
Hey. Attacking on with answering this question, obviously, is the other reason that the RCD model, I've been hearing you and Costis, is that the grave, obviously, the spirit of God hovering over waters is a very strong inference that there was life in the ocean at that time period when the spirit hovered, because that word hovered is really brood, and the other time it's used in the Bible is talking about birth, you know, protecting its young, just as if the Holy Spirit was over the waters, hovering.
Yeah, that's one reason we take that point of view. It's an implication. It's not an explicit statement. But as you look at the parallel creation accounts to Genesis 1, they treat the 6 days of creation in the context of life. So in that sense, it would, again, imply that we have God creating life on all 6 days. So, but, you know, again, there isn't anything explicit, but as you integrate all these accounts, I think you do get that pattern. Yeah, Al.
I think we're still on the seventh day. We're still resting. Anyhow,
God's still at rest. He's not creating physically at this point in time.
He's not snoring.
Well,
you, Al.
That's what we're talking about here in Psalm 139. God is resting from his work of creation miracles, but he's intervening in the life of every human being in supernatural ways. And maybe this would be a good time to jump there, because I didn't think this discovery was going to take that long. But
one question.
Yeah.
We keep saying that during the Big Bang, that the physics, the law of physics were created. Isn't that the law of physics a human invention? Or are you saying it's a God? God gave us those physics?
Well, the Bible does speak about laws that govern the heavens and the earth, Jeremiah 33:25. So from a biblical perspective, it does seem to imply that when God created the universe, he set up certain laws to govern the cosmos. So, from an astronomical perspective, the laws have always been there. And we have experiments now where we can measure the laws 13 billion years ago. And those laws measure to be identical to the laws we see today.
They've been discovered by scientists, not by God.
Correct. But, you know, if God creates the universe, so it makes sense he would create the laws to govern it.
We're down the rabbit hole again.
You know, the Bible clearly does state that God has set up spiritual laws for the heavenly realm and physical laws for our universe. And astronomers have confirmed that's one of the proofs we have that the Bible must be the inspired word of God. Because thousands of years ago, it talked about these laws of physics and talked about them being held constant throughout the 7 days. When the seventh day ends, they'll change, but, you know. Okay, yeah.
Is it simpler to put into terms, it's kind of like getting a new TV and a remote without the instructions. God designed it, built it, left it there, and we show up, but there's no instructions. So we have to figure out how the remote works, and then in that process, we uncover.
That's a good analogy. That works.
We're talking about an intelligent designer.
Right.
Yeah. Al, I design electronic group, but I resent that remark.
I work on
them to fix it. I'll let the two of you debate this after class. But you know, the previous creation account we discussed here was Psalm 104, and it just kind of lays out, as the other creation accounts do, just how busy and active and intimate God is throughout the six creation days, and preparing the physical universe, the earth, and all of Earth's life for human beings. And then when he creates Adam and Eve, he rests from his work of creation. And what we're seeing here in Psalm 139, which is a creation account in human origins, and eventually I'm going to give you the scoop on human origins as we get through Psalm 139. But what we've been doing, trying to set that up, is making the point in King David's words here that God was intervening in the physical creation throughout the 6 days. On day 7, he stops that, but now his focus is on working in the lives of human beings. And he testifies of his own life, how he realizes that during this 7th day of rest, just how active God is in supernaturally intervening in the different events that takes place in his life. And what we've been documenting as you go through 1 Samuel 15 through to 31 is that there are 30 times in 13 years that God intervenes to supernaturally save the life of King David. Now, I'm not saying that's going to be the way it is for all of us, because after all, King David was a target of Satan. We looked at Genesis chapter 3, where God told Eve, your offspring are the ones that are going to bruise the head of Satan, and that Satan would strike at the heel of the offspring of the woman. And how busy Satan has been to attack the line coming from the woman. And of course, Satan realized, because he studies the Bible too, that it was going to be through David that the Messiah would come. And so naturally you can understand why he's so focused on trying to disrupt the destiny of King David and his offspring. But literally, between the time David was 17 and the time he was 30 years of age, God intervened supernaturally. And let me hit a couple we haven't covered yet, because it gets more amazing as you go through these 20 incidences. I mean, what we see towards the end here is that you've got David escaping from the town of Keilah. It's a town he rescued. It's a town he rescued from the destruction of the Philistines, so all the citizens were very beholden to David. But when King Saul shows up with his army, King David says, you know, I'd better consult with the Thummim and the Urim from the priest that was with him. He had the high priest with him. And he said, asked of God, will the citizens of Keilah protect me, or will they hand me over to Saul? And what God told him is, they're going to hand you over to Saul. So that's an interesting situation. Here he just risked his life and the lives of his men to rescue the citizens, and immediately after the rescue, they don't show very much gratefulness. You'd expect that they would defend him, but he said no, so he decided to escape, and he escaped in the nick of time. Saul reached the city and was very angry that David and his men had escaped. So Saul gathers up his army of 3,000 men and pursues David through Horesh in the desert of Ziph, as the text says, day after day. And it was such that there were instances where David's 600 men were on one side of a hill and Saul and his 3,000 men were on the other side of the hill. David was running and in close pursuit with Saul and his army. And Saul pursues David continually and eventually traps him in En Gedi. En Gedi is, I've been to En Gedi. It's kind of by the Dead Sea in Israel, and it's a box canyon. It's about the boxiest canyon I've ever seen in my life. You've got this narrow ravine here, and it goes straight up into the high hills above the Dead Sea. Literally rises about 3,000 feet. And it's a relatively a short valley. There's a waterfall at the end. You know, it's a great place to have your troops because there's water and there is some green foliage at the bottom. So it's about the only place in that entire area where you got water and some possible food that you can use to feed your animals. But Saul was at the opening and David and his men were at the back. And so Saul had him trapped. Well, you can read the story in 1 Samuel 24. Of how David was able to escape certain death, and as the soldiers with him, certain death. That's actually kind of a humorous story where Saul goes into a cave to relieve himself, And while he's relieving himself, King David comes up with a little knife and cuts off a piece of his robe and hides in the back, waits for Saul to exit the cave, goes to the entrance of the cave, and waves the little piece of cloth that he cut from. So this is what I did while you were relieving yourself, and making the point, I could have killed you on the spot, and they would have anointed me king right away, but I didn't do that. And it so humbled Saul that he backed off and pulled his troops out of En-Gedi, which gave David a chance to escape the Box Canyon. But as soon as he got out, what happened? Saul changed his mind and started to chase him again. So Saul pursues David with 3,000 men to the hill of Hakalah, and that's where David's on one side and Saul's on the other, and David makes a narrow escape, mainly because he, with his smaller force, was able to run away a little faster. And then David realized, I've got nowhere to go, because now he'd been cut off from going back down to the wilderness. He was cut off from going to Jerusalem. He was really being trapped. In fact, he was being pushed against the borders of Philistia. And if you actually look at a map of Israel, you can see why David decided to take refuge with his enemy, the king of Gath. Because here was Saul pressing him against the borders of Philistia. He was either going to get wiped out by Saul, or he's going to have to depend on the mercy of his ardent enemy. Now, talk about being between a rock and a hard place. Okay, after all, David was the one that had killed, as the song says, tens of thousands of Philistines. And here's Saul trapping against the border of Philistia. And so David decides to take an incredible chance and cross the border. Now, he'd already been there once. Remember, he'd escaped into Philistia once, and he had to feign insanity in order to get away from the king of Gath. And so you wonder, okay, here's the king of Gath. He's got David in his grips. He can kill him and all of his men and be done with the enemy of Israel. Or he can say, you know, this guy was insane when he was with me before. What's going on now? As you read the story in that context, you can just see how God was supernaturally intervening in such a way that this ruthless king of Gath decided to take mercy upon David and bring him in to his fold and even give him a town to live. He was able to take refuge for many years. So, however, when the Philistines went to war against Israel and against King Saul, Achish, the king of Gath, expected David to march out against the Israelites. Now, David again realized he's between a rock and a hard place. If I don't march out, they're going to kill us all. If I do march out, I'm going to lose any chance I've got of being king over Israel, because none of the Israelites will ever trust me again. But he put his faith in God and said, I will march out, expressed his loyalty to the king of Gath who had given him refuge. But God worked it out so that the soldiers that were with the king of Gath says, look, this is the guy that is famous for killing all of us Philistines. He's not marching out with us. And so the king of Gath reluctantly goes to David and says, look, I really want you to march with me. I trust you completely, but the rest of my officers say, no way. You're going to have to excuse yourself from the battle. And then David protested. And everybody wonders, why did David protest? If he didn't protest, he would have been killed on the spot. So, he did the right thing. And then they go back to their town, and what do they discover? That the Amalekites have come in there and have destroyed the city of Ziklag. And that's the city where King David and his 600 troops had their women and children. The women and children were gone, and all their belongings were gone. So, how did David's men react? They decided, we're going to kill David. They blamed David for the fact that all their women and children and all their belongings were taken away by these Amalekites. So they were going to stone him to death. And then God intervened and gave David a plan, saying, wait a minute, we might be able to chase these guys down. Now, they're more numerous, and they're a long ways away, but God supernaturally intervened that David was able to actually gather up his 600 men, overtake these people. They were drunk, and so because they were drunk, even though they were more numerous, David and his men were able to overcome them. And what does it say? Not one of their children or wives were harmed. They got back all of their children and women intact. in spite of this marauding party that have taken advantage. And that's often the way it is that when two nations are warring against one another, a third group will come in and try to take advantage. And that's what happened there. So bottom line, David saw many instances of God supernaturally intervening to save his life and the life of his 30 mighty men. If you haven't already done so, go into your Bibles, start at 1 Samuel 15, and read all the way through to the end of 1 Samuel. And again, look at it in context. Get your little map of Israel out and just see where David was going as he was trying to run away from Saul. And it becomes quite evident the degree to which God was supernaturally intervening to preserve his life. And in one sense, you can say, well, didn't David know he was going to be the future king? Well, I think all of us have been in those positions where we had those kinds of promises from God, but it's one thing to hear the promise. It's another thing to actually believe it and act upon it. And, you know, it was definitely a traumatic time for King David. Now, David not only saw instances of God supernaturally intervening to save his life and the life of his men, and particularly his 30 mighty men, and God had a very good reason for preserving these 30 mighty men, because God's intent was to use them to bring about the end of the Nephilim. It was David's 30 mighty men that exterminated the last of the Nephilim, the Anakim, the giants, the Rephaim. Those are all names for the same kinds of creatures who are, you know, taller than 9 feet, some of them up to 13 feet in height, and all of them male, all of them evil, some of them, if not all of them, with birth defects. And this is an evil that God wanted rid from the face of the earth, and he used David's 30 mighty men. Now, as you read to the end of 1 Samuel, you'll see how God supernaturally intervened not only to preserve David's life, but the lives of his 30 mighty men. And these 30 mighty men were there to serve two purposes, to deliver the human race from the last of the Rephaim or the Nephilim, but also to save David from the attacks from his own sons. It was these 30 mighty men that held the forces of King David together when David's own sons were rebelling against him and his purposes. And again, if you read towards the end of 1 Samuel, you'll see that one of these mighty men actually held off an entire army of the Philistines, killing 800 of them in a field single-handedly. You don't do that by chance. That's not an easy thing to do. And you'll see other episodes. It talks about the exploits of these 30 mighty men. But as you read the stories of these are exploits that have never been exhibited in battle before and only shows up in the Bible as a clear instance of God's supernatural intervention. But you know, in Psalm 139, David also talks about death. How God controls the day of our birth, the location of our birth. He controls the day of our death, the location of our death, and everything else that happens in between. It's all under his control. And so as you read through 1 Samuel, you'll see instances of God supernaturally intervening to bring death. And so David saw God supernaturally intervening on many occasions to bring death. Now, clearly, to bring death to his enemies, because there would be no nation Israel unless God were to intervene and take care of the Philistines and take care of the Edomites, the Ammonites, to take care of, the Aramites. But he also intervenes to preserve the line of David down through the Messiah. And God's intent was that Solomon would be king, but there was a lot of sons standing between Solomon and the throne. And so we have the death of Saul and Jonathan. And if Jonathan had still been alive, then that would have been a problem for David taking the throne, because he was the heir apparent of Saul. And he had the tribes of Israel that were loyal to Saul and Jonathan. And so it was critical that David's best friend die. I mean, that's not an easy thing to comprehend. The Lord intervening to bring about the death of your best friend. But if God hadn't intervened to bring about the death of David's best friend, then that would have been a real issue for David getting control over the throne. And then what we notice is that God intervenes to bring about the death of his three eldest sons and Bathsheba's firstborn. all of them have stood in the way. And again, you can read the story. Ammon, the firstborn, gets killed by Absalom. You can read the story. It's a freak story that brings about the death of Ammon. Kiliab, the secondborn, we don't know. But clearly, he's not alive by the time David takes the throne. Probably died of natural causes sometime in his youth. And then Joab intervenes to kill Absalom. And then Bathsheba's firstborn son dies. And then later on, we see Benaiah executing Adonijah. So five sons that were ahead of Solomon in taking the throne all experienced death in extremely unusual ways. And so, but then it was God's plan all along, it'd be through Solomon that the line would come. And after all, the wisest man that ever ruled over Israel was indeed this King Solomon. Any other king, we'd be missing the book of Proverbs, we'd be missing the Song of Psalms, and we'd be missing the book of Ecclesiastes. He wrote three Old Testament books. Let's see, I had a question I've been ignoring here and here. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, at that time, I don't know what the time period that was when David was doing all this and God was helping to eradicate most of the tribes around it. It looks like it was to consolidate the nation of Israel. It looks like a start to the nation of Israel. But did David actually see God, or was it just saying, yeah, he helped us do this? Or was God at that time visible to humans, to humanity, or is this like it is now?
Well, it's always been that way. As Paul says in Thessalonians, no man has seen God or can see God. It's impossible for us to see God. And if we could see God, he wouldn't be God. I mean, he transcends the universe. So it's... what you can get over there is a little DVD called Beyond the Cosmos, where I kind of do a little table demonstration with a couple called Mr. and Mrs. Flat, who have the handicap of only having two dimensions on a third dimension, making the point that if I were to put, let me just say these two cards here are Mr. and Mrs. Flat, and I put them in a flat universe that only has length and width. I'm a three-dimensional being. I can put my hand above them, which means that in a third dimension, I'm now physically closer to them than they are to one another. But because I'm in a different dimension than they are, a height dimension, not length and width, they can't see me, they can't touch me, even though I'm closer to them physically than they are to one another. The Bible also says that God sees us in ways we can't see one another. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Flat, as they look at one another, all they see is an outer outline. But because I have a third dimension, I get to see the insides. Likewise, the Bible tells us God sees inside our soul and spirit in a way that we cannot see within our own selves. He knows us better than we know ourselves.
He was visible at some time there. He actually came and had a wrestling match, I think, with somebody, and he walked around. Well, he has been visible according to the Bible.
Well, God the Father does not have a body. He is spirit. Likewise, the Holy Spirit. But God the Son has a body. And so when God appears in physical form, it's the second person of the Trinity. And in the incarnation, it says that the second person of the Trinity, the Messiah, left the powers that he shared with God the Father and God the Holy Spirit and humbled himself. It'd be like me as a three-dimensional being saying, you know what? I'm going to come and visit these two-dimensional characters, but I'm going to visit them in their state. I'm going to get rid of one of my dimensions. I'm going to confine myself to just two dimensions, which is what Philippians is saying when it says the Messiah, the creator of the universe, humbled himself and lowered himself and became a human being. He basically let go of all those powers in order that he could personally communicate with us.
But they saw him before the resurrection.
There were instances where God appears in physical form before the resurrection, isolated incidences. Abraham is probably the prime example, where it talks about the Lord and two angels being physically fed by Abraham. But it's a brief episode, and it's different from the incarnation, and you know, isolated situations. Not God the Father, it's God the Son that would be visiting them. So... He's always had a body. He's had a body before. he's out of body after us. God does not change. But he did humble himself and lower himself during the incarnation. Why? Because the only way to come to faith in Christ and receive the pardon of all of our sins is through humility. And one of the things Jesus did is to give us a personal example of the humility we need in order to come into relationship with God. I mean, what greater act of humility could you experience? The creator of the universe himself coming to earth as a baby where he needed his diapers changed. I mean, that's an incredible act of humility. But it gave us an example that we could follow. Okay. How are we doing on time? We're out of time. Okay. Where I want to go with this, I'm going to share with you next week just what I really want you to do is share from your own life experiences situations like this, where God clearly intervened in a supernatural way to preserve your life or to bring about the death of someone that was getting in the way or the death was part of God's plan. By the way, it's not always negative. Sometimes it's positive. I mean, a good example of this would be Stephen, where God brought an early death to Stephen, the leader of the deacons of the early church, in order that through his early death, a ministry could be established for some remarkable men. And if it wasn't for Stephen being willing to die at an early age, we'd be missing almost half the New Testament books. So sometimes an early death can be a means by which, and in one sense you could say that of this baby of Bathsheba, that opened the way for Solomon to be established in his ministry. Anyway, I want to get some testimonies from you. And I'm prepared to start with a few of my own, but you know what? I want to shut up. I want to hear from you. And so if things drag in this class, I'll share one. But as long as you keep pumping them, I'm going to keep quiet. So that's the rule we're going to bring next week. But I think the point I want to drive home is this. If God is so clearly intervening in supernatural ways to prepare his physical creation for human beings, it would make sense that during the day of rest, he would also supernaturally intervene in remarkable ways, even to the point of saving your life from certain death and bringing about death where it's necessary in order that he could achieve our purpose. So in one sense, the testimony we see of the 6 days gives us confidence that God is at work today in our own lives in the kind of detail that David describes in Psalm 139. Psalm 139 is not just for King David. It's for every human being who has ever lived. And I hope to generate lots of testimonies from you to prove that point in an abundant way. Okay, so that's where we're going. Let's just pause for prayer, and we'll pick this up next week. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for giving us your servant, David. Lord, for how you anointed him and blessed him throughout his life, but also inspired him to write holy scriptures that can benefit us 3,000 years later. And Lord, as we go through the remainder of the creation accounts in the book of Psalms, and particularly David's creation Psalms, Father, help us to gain insights. Lord, show us things that we might otherwise miss, that we can really appreciate the degree to which you worked in his life and are working in our lives in very intimate and detailed ways. In Jesus' name, amen.